Thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to this week's Torah portion from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. This message is brought to you by themessianicmessage.com. themessianicmessage.com. I hope that you enjoy this teaching. This week's Torah portion is Korah, and it's Numbers 16, verse 1 to chapter 18, verse 32. The Haftarah is 1 Samuel 11, starting at verse 14 to chapter 12, verse 22, and the Brit Hadashah is Romans 13, verses 1 to 7. And before we get started, let's say a word of prayer. Baruch atah Yehovah Eloheinu Melech haolam. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, Creator of all things, Giver of your Torah. And I thank you, Abba, for giving us your Torah and leading us in your paths. And I thank you for the things that you have given me to share. And I ask that you would just bless your words and let my words fall to the ground and die. And Abba, protect your people around the world wherever they are, and bless us as we keep your Shabbat. I ask in the name of Yeshua. Amen. Okay, let's start at chapter 16, verse 1 of the book of Numbers. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, son of Kohath, son of Levi, and Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, son of Reuben, took men. All right, let's find out who these people are first in this Torah portion. Let's go to Numbers chapter 3, verse 19, where it says, And the sons of Kohath by their clans, Amram, Izhar, Hebron, and Uziel. To Kohath belonged the clan of the Amramites, and the clan of the Izharites, and the clan of the Hebronites, and the clan of the Uzielites. These are the clans of the Kohathites. The clans of the sons of Kohath were to camp on the south side of the tabernacle. So now we have an idea of who Korah is. Korah is the firstborn son of Izhar, who is the firstborn son of Kohath, the son of Levi, but Kohath was the secondborn son of Levi. Gershon was the firstborn son of Levi. And Moses and Aaron were the sons of Amram. That makes them cousins of Korah. Now you'll notice that in this group are Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, son of Reuben. Now, that word there in verse 1 that says sons, plural of Reuben, in the Hebrew, it's simply benai. It is not plural word, so it's just a mistranslation there. But what you have is the sons of Eliab, Dathan and Abiram, are related to Zebulun. You can find their genealogy in Numbers chapter 1, verse 9. So what you have here is Korah, the firstborn of Izhar, who is the secondborn of Kohath. Then you have Dathan and Abiram, who are from Leah's youngest son, Zebulun. And you have On, who is descendant of Reuben, who is Leah's oldest son. Now, later on, we're going to learn about Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. And on Mount Ebal is where the concubines' sons go, and Reuben and Zebulun. Now, there are reasons why Reuben and Zebulun go there, and I'm not going to go into that. Mount Ebal is the mountain of the cursing. But I am going to speculate here that possibly Zebulun was chosen to go to Mount Ebal because of what Dathan and Abiram did here. That there is a message in him being sent over to Mount Ebal because of the rebellion that happens here in this Torah portion. And so we learned the association between rebellion and cursing. And so that choice to put Zebulun with Reuben and the concubine's son on Mount Ebal might actually be, among other things, a reminder of this Korah incident. I'm sure I'll have more to say on that when we get to that Torah portion. Nonetheless, the whole point of that was to show us that it is our behavior that gets us our place in the kingdom, and this Torah portion has everything to do with behavior. Now, we're going to take a look at the meaning of the name Korah. It is Strong's 7139. It's a Kof Resh Hay, and it means to depilate. Well, what that means is to make yourself bald. You know, ladies understand this, that when they go into Walmart to get one of those creams that they put on their legs to take the hair off their legs, well, what they're using is a depilatory. They are making themselves bald. So that's what the word Korah means in that instance. That's the name. But there are two related words that are spelled with exactly the same Hebrew letters, Kof, Resh, Hey, and that next one is Strong 7140, and it means ice, as if bald or smooth, okay? And then Strong 7141, again, Kof, Resh, Hey, means ice, and it's the name of two Edomites and three Israelites. And so Korah is bald, ice, and smooth, okay? Now, what can we get out of that? Well, it means that Korah is one who has made himself smooth, as in a smooth talker, and he is cold and icy. You see, he's got that personality that's just real cold and prickly, as they say in the human resources departments everywhere. You know, we want to be soft and fuzzy or whatever they say instead of cold and prickly. I remember those seminars from years ago. Anyway, Korah is your cold, prickly guy. You see, he's a smooth talker, but he's icy. And you know, ice can be very sharp and very hurtful. Now, one of the things we should remember is that Korah is a Kohathite, as I said before, but the Kohathites got special protection. Remember when they were moving, when the cloud would move and they would all head out? Well, Korah got special attention because they were in charge of the holy items of the sanctuary. We find this in Numbers chapter 4, verses 15 and 18, which said, "And when Aaron and his sons have finished covering the sanctuary and all the furnishings of the sanctuary as the camp sets out, after that, the sons of Kohath shall carry these, but they must not touch the holy things, lest they die. These are the things of the tent of meeting that the sons of Kohath are to carry. Let not the tribe of the clans of the Kohathites be destroyed from among the Levites." That right there is going to be very important when we get to chapter 18, because it's possible that in the rebellion of Korah that the Lord might have been tempted to destroy all of the Kohathites. But here he has said that we're not going to let the tribe of the clans of the Kohathites be destroyed from among the Levites. So let's go to verse 2. "And they rose up before Moses with a number of the people of Israel, 250 chiefs of the congregation chosen from the assembly, well-known men." So 250 men rose up against him, against Moses. "And they assembled themselves together against Moses and against Aaron and said to them, 'You have gone too far, for all in the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord?'" Oh my. Well, what Korah is doing here is he is stepping up to the plate from the last Torah portion when the children of Israel said, "Let us take a leader for ourselves and go back to Egypt." And Korah just thought, well, that's his cue. Now he's going to step up. And the first thing he does is start to twist the word of the Lord. Do you hear the smooth talk? You hear that ice, that baldness of him? And was he correct in what he says? Is the whole congregation holy, every one of them? And the Lord is among them. Are those three statements true? Is the congregation holy? Is everyone in the congregation holy? And is the Lord among them? Well, it depends on how you look at it. You see, this is one of those things that I've been starting to realize lately, that if we take a statement or a doctrine, an interpretation, an opinion, and look at it from all different angles, well, you can say, well, it depends on how you look at it. But the Lord wants us to do behaviors. He wants us to act in certain ways and think about the doctrines and interpretations of them later on. So we have here a perfect example of how somebody can twist the Lord's words into making a doctrine that sounds good but isn't quite there, because that whole congregation is not holy. Everyone in that congregation is not holy, and the Lord is kind of among them, but not really. Because where the Lord is, he's in the tabernacle. That's where the priests are. All of the children of Israel are not in the tabernacle. So, technically speaking, the Lord is among them, but the Lord doesn't dwell over them. He doesn't cast his cloud over them. He casts it over the tabernacle. And so we have here, as I said, Korah is twisting the Lord's words. And so in verse 4, when Moses heard it, he fell on his face. Well, the very first action we should take when the adversity hits us is to fall on our face. It's the sign of humility, but it's the sign of the kind of humility that is ready to let the Lord handle the situation. So falling on our face is actually an act of worship and of handing over the situation to the Lord. And in verse 5, and he said to Korah and all his company, in the morning the Lord will show who is his and who is holy, and will bring him near to him. The one whom he chooses, he will bring near to him. Do this, take censers, Korah and all his company, put fire in them, put incense on them before the Lord tomorrow, and the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the holy one. You have gone too far, sons of Levi. And Moses said to Korah, hear now, you sons of Levi, is it too small a thing for you that the God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do service in the tabernacle of the Lord, and to stand before the congregation to minister to them? You see, Korah was already given a ministry by the Lord, but apparently he didn't want the ministry that the Lord gave to him. Verse 10, and that he has brought you near to him and all your brothers, the sons of Levi, with you, and you would seek the priesthood also? Yes, that's exactly what Korah wants. He believes that he's more qualified, because he too is a firstborn. He's a firstborn of Izhar. And now, there are people who believe that Korah actually was some kind of an accountant in the Egyptian palace, and because that's where he worked, he believes that, you know, that gave him some kind of extra qualification to do what he wanted to do in the priesthood. The other thing is that, if you'll remember, in the ancient Near East, firstborns were taken to be in the role of priests in those cultures. And so it's likely that the Hebrew firstborns served in priestly capacities in Egyptian temples, just like Aaron. Remember, we've talked about that in the past. So Korah has this notion that he is every bit as qualified, if not more qualified, because look, he has come to Moses with 250 men who are princes of the children of Israel. I mean, he obviously has all the weight on his side. People like him a lot better because he's a smooth, cool talker, right? So, therefore, he thinks that because of his previous priestly experience, he can do everything that Aaron can do, and he can run the priesthood better than Aaron. He's just got this kind of hubris that says this, except that he fails to see that the priesthood is a spiritual priesthood, and it's Jehovah's choice, and that you don't inherit something or get a ministry just because that's what you want. You see, he does not yet understand the spiritual principles that the Lord has been laying down for them for the last 2 years. Numbers 16:11. Therefore, it is against the Lord. Now, this is Moses talking. Therefore, it is against the Lord that you and your company have gathered together. What is Aaron that you grumble against him? Well, see, Moses is right. It is against the Lord. They don't have a problem, really, with Moses and Aaron. What they're having a problem with is the Lord, and we're going to see that as we continue to read. Verse 12, "And Moses sent to call Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and they said, 'We will not come up. Is it a small thing that you have brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness, that you must also make yourself a prince over us?'" Well, you see, right here, Dathan and Abiram are denouncing the land of their inheritance and saying Egypt was the land flowing with milk and honey. Now, we just learned in last week's Torah portion that the Lord said 5 times in the book of Exodus that his land, the land of the inheritance of Abraham, was the land that was flowing with milk and honey. But they're telling the Lord that Egypt flows with milk and honey. Now, Dathan was likely the firstborn son of Eliab, the descendant of Zebulun. And this is important because you'll remember in Genesis 47, in verses 22 and 26, we learned about some priests that did not lose land when all of that economic mess happened in Egypt. In Genesis 47, verse 22, it says, "Only the land of the priests bought he not, for the priests had a portion assigned them of Pharaoh, and did eat their portion which Pharaoh gave them, wherefore they sold not their lands. And Joseph made it a law over the land of Egypt to this day, that Pharaoh should have the fifth part, except the land of the priests only, which became not Pharaoh's." Now, I have, as I taught in previous Torah portions, I have a theory that the firstborn of Egypt were participating in the priesthood of the Egyptians. And I believe that right here in Genesis 47, verses 22 and 26, we see that there is a hint of this, because every year when we go through that Torah portion in Genesis 47, somebody asks me, well, who were those priests? Well, they were the firstborn of the people of Egypt. Every firstborn had to serve as part of their temple worship, whatever demon deity that, they would assign you to, or you chose, or however that worked, I'm not sure. But the firstborns of that culture served as priests. And so the Levites did not get involved in the mess with the children of Israel. Do you recall that? And so I believe that there were firstborns in the Levites, among the Levites, who were serving as temple priests, and that Dathan, who was the firstborn of Eliab, and Korah, who was the firstborn of Izhar, and then On, who was the firstborn of Peleth, who we don't really know if he was the firstborn or not. That's only mentioned right there in that one verse. But if he was, then that would be one reason why he would join in with this rebellion. And so, you see, what we've got here are some men who were firstborns in Egypt, who were serving in the temples, and they had their portion there with the priests who were not touched. And let me tell you what, if you are in the upper crust of society, like the priests of Pharaoh were, and you're not touched by the hardship, you would think that Egypt was a land flowing with milk and honey. And you would not be liking this trip through the wilderness, you see, because you'd be very used to something else. And I think that's also playing into this rebellion here. Numbers 16, verse 14. "Moreover, you have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor given us inheritance of fields and vineyards. Will you put out the eyes of these men? We will not come up." Treachery. This is treachery. It's willful rebellion. And remember, there is no forgiveness for willful rebellion. That's why they are going to die in this Torah portion. You know, it is not for Moses to take the children of Israel into the land. It's for them to cooperate with the Lord to go into the land. Moses can't force 3 million or however many people were there to go into the land if they don't want to go. They have to cooperate with the Lord, but they're laying it all on Moses, and they have continued to reject the land of their inheritance. So now there is a legal issue here, because the Lord has said that he's going to keep a promise that he made to Abraham, and so we've got a problem now. Now, the attitude of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram will be that of some people in the camps of the righteous in the end of days. This will be the attitude of those who have not severed ties with the Babylonian system, and they have not severed ties with their personal stuff yet. Verse 15, and Moses was very angry and said to the Lord, "Do not respect their offering. I have not taken one donkey from them, and I have not harmed one of them." So you see, it is okay to be angry with a situation. It's called righteous anger. In verse 16, Moses said to Korah, "Be present, you and all your company, before the Lord, you and they and Aaron tomorrow. And let every one of you take his censer, put incense on it, and every one of you bring before the Lord his censer, 250 censers, you also and Aaron each his censer." So every man took his censer and put fire in them and laid incense on them and stood at the entrance of the tent of meeting with Moses and Aaron. Now look, here's what we're going to have. We're going to have another pagan ritual from Egypt. Remember, pagans present incense to their demons when they approach. Now, Moses was smart enough to know that the only one who would have the right kind of incense was Aaron. Do you remember what happened to Nadab and Abihu when they offered the strange incense? And do you remember that teaching that I gave? Well, we're going to have the same thing here, only it's just not happening at the bronze altar. Now, the pagans believe that not only can they summon their deities, but that they literally control the deities. Korah was going under the assumption that his personal strength would gain him the approval of Jehovah, because in Egypt, with the Egyptian deities, this would have been the case. Back in Egypt, whoever it was that did the better magic ranked higher with the deities and in Egyptian the Egyptian priesthood and in their society. But how Jehovah selects his holy ones is very different from all of those other demon deities and the societies that worship those demon deities. Demons, you see, have to select people based on the visible personal strength. Why? Because demons cannot read your heart. Demons cannot read your thoughts. Only Jehovah can do that, and Jehovah makes selections based on the heart. You see, why we have all this digital technology right now with the implants and all that stuff that's starting to come out, that's how Lucifer and his demons will become omnipresent and omniscient, you see, because that's the only way that they'll ever be able to read your thoughts, you see. Numbers 16, verse 19, then Korah assembled all the congregation against them at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord appeared to all the congregation. Well, you would think that would be enough to make someone back off, but Korah might have thought that the cloud appeared when Moses manipulated it with a trick or a ritual or something like that, because remember, he's having all this Egypt thought still, you see. And Korah probably thought that he could get the glory of the Lord to do the same thing, you know, that he could learn to manipulate the cloud and the pillar of fire and all of that. You see, that was just a magnificent, wonderful trick, you know. Now, I don't know how he explained the Red Sea and the, you know, clearing up the bitter waters and bringing the manna and all of that. I don't know what kind of trick that Korah thought that was, but apparently Korah's still got his mind back in Egypt, you see. And so he's not really comprehending that you don't manipulate Jehovah. You obey Jehovah's commands, and he allows you to live. That's really the lesson here in this Torah portion. So the Lord's glory appears in order to validate his choice of Aaron as priest. Now let's go to Leviticus chapter 9, verses 22 and 23. And Aaron lifted up his hand toward the people and blessed them, and came down from offering of the sin offering and the burnt offering and peace offerings. And Moses and Aaron went into the tabernacle of the congregation and came out and blessed the people. And the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. You see, the Lord's glory appears when he is validating his choice of Aaron as priest. And so that's what's going on here. The Lord appeared to all the congregation, just like in Leviticus chapter 9. So Korah is willingly committing treachery, willful sin, defiance, and he's also defying the Lord's choice. He is defying the covenant. This man is just in all kinds of hot water. Now, when rebels want you out of a ministry, this is the thing that they do. They gather up everyone against you, and they bring, you know, the leaders that will, you know, follow them, and then all those leaders, they have people, and this is what happens in ministries when somebody is about to split up the congregation. They bring everybody that they can muster against the leader. But what does the Lord tell Moses and Aaron to do? Verse 21, "Separate yourselves from among this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment." You see, the reason that God wanted to kill Korah is because Korah was trying to defeat the Lord himself. Korah was at war with Jehovah. Korah was against this covenant of Abraham. He was trying to stop Jehovah from keeping his promise to Abraham. This is the legal issue that I mentioned just a couple of minutes ago. So he is defying the covenant. Now the Lord has a legal issue against him. Oh, and by the way, it's this legal issue that the Lord is going to visit upon all the people of the earth during the tribulation. And in the camps, people are going to find out that going against the leadership there will be the same thing as when they go against the Abrahamic covenant. Because when you go against God's leadership, you're going against the Abrahamic covenant, when that leadership is trying to lead you back into the land. The Lord will accomplish plan A, and those who try to stop him will die, as in this case here that we're going to see in just a minute. But let me explain something. We have a lot of this kind of attitude among the believers of the Hebrew Roots community. They are rebels. They are people who will split a congregation in order to start their own ministry. It's the same principle in those instances as this Korah splitting this congregation away from Moses and Aaron. Now, go to Numbers 16:22. "And they fell on their faces and said, O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin, and will you be angry with all the congregation?" You see, when we fall on our face, it shows that we are not in control. It shows that we are giving control to Jehovah, and it shows that we do not command Jehovah. It shows that he commands us. Verse 23, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Say to the congregation, Get away from the dwelling of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram." So it looks like the Lord will spare the congregation, but in order to be spared, you have to separate from the rebels. Verse 25, "Then Moses rose and went to Dathan and Abiram, and the elders of Israel followed him. And he spoke to the congregation, saying, Depart, please, from the tents of these wicked men, and touch nothing of theirs, lest you be swept away with all their sins. So they got away from the dwelling of Korah, Dathan and Abiram, and Dathan and Abiram came out and stood at the door of their tents, together with their wives, their sons, and their little ones." Boy, they are being so defiant. "And Moses said, Hereby you shall know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works, and that it has not been of my own accord." See, this is very important. The Lord calls who he calls, and no one has any say in it. If these men die as all men die, or if they are visited by the fate of all mankind, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord creates something new, and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that belongs to them, and they go down alive into Sheol, then you shall know that these men have despised the Lord. And as soon as he had finished speaking all these words, the ground under them split apart, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up with their households and all the people who belonged to Korah and all their goods. So they and all that belonged to them went down alive into Sheol, and the earth closed over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. And all Israel who were around them fled at their cry, for they said, "Lest the earth swallow us up." And fire came out from the Lord and consumed the 250 men offering the incense. See, same thing that happened to Nadab and Abihu. These men were present when Nadab and Abihu died. You know, Nadab and Abihu, who were ordained as priests to Jehovah. You know, these men here, these 250 men, they're not even priests, although they were anointed for another specific work having to do with the tabernacle. Did they not think that if they did the same thing as Nadab and Abihu, that somehow they'd be spared or they'd overcome the Lord? I mean, this is the Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who destroyed the Egyptian army where they just left, for crying out loud. This is just, you know, this story is just one of, I'm just so amazed at anybody who could think that they're going to go do battle with the Lord and win. There are two ways that I believe that the Lord may purge rebels out of the camps of the righteous at the end of days. Have to do with those who do not go into captivity, those rebels that happen to make it into the camps. Number one is, I believe the earth could swallow them. Number two is, the Lord could just burn them to ashes right where they stand. Of course, there is a third possibility. Perhaps, as I've said in the past, we will be called upon to set people outside the camps as well, and that will be certain death as well. Number 16:36. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Tell Eleazar the son of Aaron the priest to take up the censers out of the blaze. Then scatter the fire far and wide, for they have become holy. As for the censers of these men who have sinned at the cost of their lives, let them be made into hammered plates as a covering for the altar, for they offered them before the Lord, and they became holy. Thus they shall be a sign to the people of Israel." So Eleazar the priest took the bronze censers which those who were burned had offered, and they were hammered out as a covering for the altar, and to be a reminder to the people of Israel, so that no outsider who is not of the descendants of Aaron should draw near to burn incense before the Lord, lest he become like Korah and his company, as the Lord said to him through Moses. So here you would think this is like the end of the story, right? But oh no, verse 41. On the next day, all the congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, saying, "You have killed the people of the Lord." Oh my goodness. These people are just so awesomely, utterly, rebellious is the only word, but they're beyond rebellious, you see? They're willful and defiant. Didn't they see the Lord open the earth? Didn't they see the Lord send the consuming fire? Yet, these children of Israel are still blaming Moses. Why do people do this? Well, it's both ignorance and hubris. If it's ignorance, it means they really don't understand that their disagreement is with God himself. You know, these people here, let me explain something. If they're having a disagreement with God, they don't know the first commandment. This is why they can't keep the commandments, why they can't follow the Lord, why they can't go in and take the land, why they just can't be obedient. They do not know this God that brought them out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, you see? And so they're ignorant on that deep spiritual level. And they don't understand that their disagreement is not with Moses and Aaron, it's with God himself. And then there's the thing of hubris. That's a little bit more like what Korah had. He knows that his argument is with God. I mean, he didn't argue with Moses when Moses said, "Your argument is with the Lord, not with me." Korah knew. Korah knew he was going to battle with God. But you see, people with this kind of hubris, with this kind of ego, they're also big cowards. So rather than battle the Lord directly, they stick one of the Lord's anointed between themselves and the Lord, you see. They can't see the Lord, so therefore, you know, they don't know the Lord. And so the one that they can see, you know, Moses, Aaron, the leader of the congregation, the teacher, the prophet, whoever it is, even today, that's who they attack. Numbers 16:42. And when the congregation had assembled against Moses and against Aaron, they turned toward the tent of meeting, and behold, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord appeared. Again, we have the glory of the Lord coming to validate that Moses and Aaron were chosen by the Lord. And Moses and Aaron came to the front of the tent of meeting, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Get away from the midst of this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment." And they fell on their faces. And Moses said to Aaron, "Take your censer and put fire on it from off the altar, and lay incense on it, and carry it quickly to the congregation, and make atonement for them, for wrath has gone out from the Lord, the plague has begun." So Aaron took it as Moses said, and ran into the midst of the assembly, and behold, the plague had already begun among the people. And he put on the incense and made atonement for the people. And he stood between the dead and the living, and the plague was stopped. Now those who died in the plague were 14,700, besides those who died in the affair of Korah. And Aaron returned to Moses at the entrance of the tent of meeting when the plague was stopped. Now, you know, we are going to have this same thing in the newly forming government of God in the camps of the righteous, right? Because that's what's going on here. You know, we have this newly formed government of God in the wilderness. And we've got some people who have decided that they want to return to Egypt. We're going to have the same thing in the camps of the righteous. And the reason I know that is because in Revelation chapter 8, we have exactly the same thing that happened here, where there has to be censer filled with incense sent to the earth in order to stop a plague that's going on. And by the way, that plague in Revelation 8 comes after the Lord opens the seventh seal, and it has something to do with the rebellion in the camps. That censer, just like the censer of Aaron, has to do with stopping the plague among God's own people. So we are going to have this kind of rebellion in the camp. In Revelation 8, verses 3 to 5, it says, "And another angel came and stood at the altar, having a golden censer. And there was given to him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar, which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense, which came with the prayer of the saints, ascended up to God out of the angel's hand. And the angel took the censer and filled it with fire of the altar, and cast it into the earth. And there were voices and thunderings and lightnings and an earthquake." And now, we're going to move on. The Lord is going to up the ante, because now we have all 12 tribes coming together against Aaron and Moses. I mean, this is unbelievable to me. So the Lord is going to give all 12 tribes the chance to, you know, come up against Aaron to see exactly who it was that, you know, the Lord appointed and who he anointed. And he's going to put a stop to the notion that just anyone can do the priest's job. Now, you see, we need to get a little bit of a handle on this, because in this Torah portion is where we need to learn that we have no right to usurp the priestly authority. And there's a lot of that going on among the people of the Lord in the Hebrew Roots community. They think that they can have the authority of the priest, they can do what the priest did, and they don't need Israel, they don't need Jerusalem, they don't need Temple Mount, they don't need the temple, and therefore they don't even need Yeshua, who is going to be running the temple. He's going to be overseeing that whole thing and the earth itself. They don't even need him because they can do the priest job right out here in the diaspora. Just like these people here in this Torah portion. They don't need the priest, right? Let's go to chapter 17, verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel, and get from them staffs, one for each father's house, from all their chiefs, according to their father's houses, 12 staffs. Write each man's name on his staff, and write Aaron's name on the staff of Levi, for there shall be one staff for the head of each father's house. Then you shall deposit them in the tent of meeting before the testimony where I meet with you. And the staff of the man whom I choose shall sprout. Thus I will make to cease from me the grumblings of the people of Israel, which they grumble against you." Moses spoke to the people of Israel, and all their chiefs gave him staffs, one for each chief, according to their father's houses, 12 staffs. And the staff of Aaron was among their staffs. And Moses deposited the staffs before the Lord in the tent of the testimony. On the next day, Moses went into the tent of the testimony, and behold, the staff of Aaron for the house of Levi had sprouted and put forth buds and produced blossoms, and it bore ripe almonds. Then Moses brought out all the staffs from before the Lord to all the people of Israel, and they looked, and each man took his staff. Now see, this is why the Lord made them all write their name, the name of their tribe, on the staff, because Moses put those staffs away where they could not see them all night long. If they had not written their names on there, well, they wouldn't know whose staff was whose. So they wrote their names on there, and then in the following morning, Moses presented the staffs to each one to the tribe that it belonged to. And the Lord said to Moses, "Put back the staff of Aaron before the testimony to be kept as a sign for the rebels, that you may make an end of their grumblings against me, lest they die." Thus did Moses as the Lord commanded him, so he did. And the people of Israel said to Moses, "Behold, we perish. We're undone. We're all undone." You see, the Hebrew Roots community needs to get their sticks out and see if their sticks will bloom. You see, we need to, let's just go and find us a Kohen and write Levi on one of those sticks, and then we'll just write the tribes on all other 11 sticks, and we'll put them someplace, you know, in Israel, and we'll let the Lord decide who gets to be the, you know, the people who can do the sacrificing and maintain the temple and take care of the implements. Is it the Kohen? Is it the priests? Or is it these people out here who are usurping that authority? Verse 13, "Everyone who comes near to the tabernacle of the Lord shall die." This is the people talking. And it says, "Are we all to perish?" You see, now they think they're going to be killed because they just lost the fight. And they've seen Nadab and Abihu lose their fight with the Lord. And they have now seen Korah, Dathan, and Abiram lose their fight with the Lord. And so now the children of Israel just think they're done for. See, they're not yet kind of comprehending that their death sentence has already been pronounced. Their death sentence is that they get to be in prison. They get to wander 40 years until they all die. You see, when they say we're all going to perish, I think at that moment, though, that they're finally getting it. I think they finally have figured out that they're going to perish without getting to go into the promised land, the land filled with milk and honey, which, by the way, is not Egypt. Chapter 18, verse 1. "So the Lord said to Aaron, 'You and your sons and your father's house with you shall bear iniquity connected with the sanctuary, and you and your sons with you shall bear iniquity connected with your priesthood.'" Now, that sounds like, you know, maybe not so fair, but as we're going to see in a little bit, I think this is very much a mercy that the Lord is doing here, and I'll share with you why in a little bit. But aside from that, the Lord is giving the high priest and the priesthood here the authority to take care of situations like this Korah thing He's giving them the authority to take care of this in the future. He's delegating responsibility. It is now their duty to make sure no one profanes the sanctuary again by coming before it in the manner that we have just witnessed in this Torah portion. And in a future Torah portion, Pinchas, we're going to learn what it means to take this authority seriously. Verse 2. And with you bring your brothers also, the tribe of Levi, the tribe of your father, that they may join you and the minister, and minister to you while you and your sons with you are before the tent of the testimony. They shall keep guard over you and over the whole tent, but shall not come near to the vessels of the sanctuary or to the altar, lest they die and you die. The Lord here is reiterating the holiness of the office of priest and the chosen priesthood. Verse 4, they shall join you and keep guard over the tent of meeting for all the service of the tent, and no outsiders shall come near you. So the Lord is providing protection for them against people such as Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And in verse 5, he says, and you shall keep guard over the sanctuary and over the altar, that there may never be wrath on the people of Israel. So even though Korah was a member of the tribe of Kohath, the Levites now have the idea that they're supposed to guard this thing. They're not supposed to be going against it. And so the Lord is reiterating to them what they have been learning is their duty. We've already, in the last two or three Torah portions, have been going over this, their duties towards the tabernacle. And so he's starting to summarize and reiterate the duties of the office of priest and the duties of the Levites that serve the priests. And so now let's jump down to verse 20. And the Lord said to Aaron, you shall have no inheritance in their land, neither shall you have any portion among them. I am your portion and your inheritance among the people of Israel. To the Levites I have given every tithe in Israel for an inheritance, in return for their service that they do, their service in the tent of meeting, so that the people of Israel do not come near the tent of meeting, lest they bear sin and die. Now right here we kind of get the sense that maybe the Lord is saying that the Levites needed to understand that their value, they had value in the tent of meeting, that they were not going to be working for free. And maybe this was one of the issues with Korah as well. We don't know, but there may be a hint of that in here. But the Levites shall do the service of the tent of meeting, and they shall bear their iniquity. It shall be a perpetual statute throughout your generations, and among the people of Israel they shall have no inheritance. Now, before we get down to verse 20, between Numbers 18, verse 6, and verse 19, there's a reiteration of things that we have learned in previous Torah portions, and so you can go back and read that. But I wanted to jump here to this section because I wanted to show you that, first of all, the Levites are given authority in the area of tithes. You know, they collect the tithes, not the priests, you see. But even more important than that is this thing about them bearing their own iniquity like the priests. Now, why does the Lord make the priests and the Levites bear their own iniquity? Well, part of it has to do with he's giving them authority. And when you take authority, then you also bear greater consequences, don't you? But earlier I said I was going to explain this to you. I believe that what the Lord is doing here is an act of mercy. Because, you see, if there is no place for the Lord to put the iniquity when it happens, then he has to kill the person who committed the crime. Because he had not given this authority yet to the Levites and to the priesthood, they could not bear Korah's iniquity. And so That's why I believe that the Lord is being merciful. He is now giving them an opportunity to not go through this again, to have the authority to deal with this again. And when there is a problem, they bear the iniquity rather than the Lord just outright killing people. I hope that that makes sense. And so I also hope that this Torah portion has been a blessing to you. And I also hope that you have a wonderful and blessed Shabbat Shalom.